Chair calls to order the meeting of the House Judiciary Committee for Thursday, January the 11th, 2007. I'd like to welcome the members of the committee and the staff and the public to this initial meeting of the committee. The Judiciary Committee has historically handled policy legislation dealing with public safety, the administration of civil justice, and matters affecting the individual rights of citizens. And based on the referral of bills that has been made to the committee so far, it looks like that will continue into the future. This is, I must warn you, members, a hard-working committee. We have historically handled in this committee more legislation than any other committee in the building, and I expect that that will continue as well based on what's coming our way. You'll notice that in the official schedule for the session, we are set for 8 o'clock a.m., 5 days a week. And the Speaker's office has reiterated to me that that was not inadvertent. They expect us to do a lot of work and to get started on early. I do have a dispensation that is temporary to start meetings at 8:30 until our workload is ramped up, but then be expecting an 8 o'clock start. And it may be that as we get into the thick of session, perhaps it'll even have to start earlier. I'd like to begin with introductions, self-introductions of the members for the benefit of other members and those who are watching us either in the room or over the video. I'd like each member to say a few words about their background and any connection they may have to the subject matter of our committee. I will start out. I'm State Representative Greg McPherson. I represent House District 38, which consists of Lake Oswego, part of Southwest Portland, and some unincorporated pockets of Multnomah and Clackamas counties. My background is I'm an attorney in private practice with a law firm in Portland, where I've been for the last 31 years. My field of practice is employee benefits, pension, profit sharing, fringe benefits. So it's a civil law practice, and mainly it's an advisory practice, although I do some advocacy. I have served on the Judiciary Committee now for two prior sessions, and most recently in the 2005 session under the very capable leadership of Representative Krieger. Now I'd like Representative Wisnant to describe his background.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Gene Wisnant. I'm honored to be serving on this committee. Both interims, I served on Judiciary. When I first was appointed in September 2003, I came in and I think I sat next to the chair on this committee. During last session, I served on Ways and Means Public Safety. So I hope I'll be able to help this committee and the chair and serve favorably and help the people in the state of Oregon. My background is I'm a state representative for District 53, Sun River. And you people are talking about snow? this is a mild spring day in Sun River. I'm retired military, 27 years in the United States Air Force, and look forward to this committee.
Representative Barker?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Jeff Barker, and I represent House District 28, which is in Beaverton, Alola. I've served on, this is my third term in the legislature. In the last two, I've served on Judiciary. Last session, I was the chair of the Subcommittee for Criminal Law. In my personal background, I'm a retired Portland Police Lieutenant. I spent over 31 years in law enforcement in Oregon, starting with the Oregon State Police, but most of my career is in Portland.
Representative Kump?
Thank you, Chair. My name's Representative Betty Kump. My house district is 22. That's Woodburn, Jervis, Brooks, and North Salem. Judiciary is going to be a new committee for me, so I'm looking forward to learning. I'm an avid learner and reader. I think I need to be that, Chair McPherson, right, to
you
serve
do.
Here. And my background is I'm a school administrator. I've spent 12 years in leadership in Woodburn School District as a high school assistant principal and 8 years as a middle school principal. And as I just shared with Representative Wisnett, if I just start playing up here, just, you know, slap me or something. But I have a lot of children in my heart, and I'm here to serve in any way I can.
Thank you. Representative Krieger?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
District 1 is mine on the Southern Oregon coast. This is my fourth term. Be the second time I've served on this committee. My freshman year I did, and then again last year. District 1 has all of Curry County, about 75% of Coos County, and then Western Douglas, all the way from I-5 at Winston-Dillard all the way down to the coast. It's kind of an odd-shaped district. I really look forward again to serving on this committee because there's a lot of work to do. It causes time to pass, and I think that we'll have things come at us this time that will benefit the people of Oregon. Thank you.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Linda Flores. I'm serving beginning my third term as state representative for House District 51, which is Clackamas, Damascus, Orem, Estacada, and a wee bit of Multnomah County. This will be my second session serving on the Judiciary Committee. My background is almost 20 years serving as a legal assistant for a sole practitioner in East Multnomah County. I spent a year in law firm, and then 10 years with the Federal Highway Administration, six of which was as a legal technician for the Regional Counsel's Office. And I'm looking forward to our business.
Thank you. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Suzanne Bonamici. I represent House District 34, which is the northeastern part of Washington County, Beaverton, and unincorporated Washington County. My work in law first started when I was a legal assistant at Lane County Legal Aid in Eugene. I then attended the University of Oregon School of Law, continuing to work at Legal Aid and for a sole practitioner in Eugene. My first job out of law school was at the Federal Trade Commission in Washington, D.C., where I served in the Bureau of Consumer Protection in the Credit Practices Division. I was there for a few years, and then I was in private practice in Portland for about 3 years until my husband and I had two children. And then I took a career break and became very involved in the community, primarily in education. I did continue in law by serving as a court tour guide for the Classroom Law Project, something I've done for the last 10 years, taking students on tours of the Multnomah County Courthouse. And I am looking forward to serving on this committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Tobias Reed. I represent District 27, which is Beaverton, a little bit of southwest Portland, and some unincorporated Washington County, replacing Representative Haas. And my background, I spent a couple of terms here working for Representative Johnston in the 90s, worked in the federal government for the Treasury Secretary in the Clinton administration. And after going to business school, I started work at Nike, where I'm a footwear developer. So I am also looking forward to learning from my fellow members and all of you. Thanks.
Good. I'd like to have the staff introduce themselves as well so we can get a sense about who's going to be helping us get our work done. In fact, I think a lot of what it takes for this committee to do its work is done actually by people who are the professional staff assisting us, Bill Taylor, our counsel, to lead off on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bill Taylor. I'm starting my 11th session as counsel from the Judiciary Committee. I've been in private practice in Portland and in Boston. I've worked for the Federal Election Commission. I worked for the Clerk of the House, and at one time for 2 years I was counsel of U.S. Capitol Police. And I met my wife in D.C. She was in Portland, and we could afford a house in Portland and couldn't in D.C., so we moved out here. I enjoy this process. It's fun and exhilarating, and the only thing I have to say, particularly to the new people, the only dumb question is the one not asked. Feel free to ask us. We may be pressed for time, but we'll find extra time to sit down and chat with you about the issues and give you our insights or places where you can get additional information. Well, unlike other committees, our staff will staff both the House and Senate Judiciary Committees. We are in many regards in staffing similar to revenue and LFO's office in the sense that we do that. Staff will follow bills from the House to the Senate side. We feel that that gives us better continuity and ensures oftentimes what's said in the House will be said in the Senate, too. Matt Kelmanson, do you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Matt Kelmanson, and I'll be working with Bill Taylor as counsel to this committee. My background is primarily in private civil law, most recently with a large law firm in Portland, and I'm honored to assist the committee in any way I can.
But I'd also like to let people know that we have Darian Stanford working for us. Darian called me this morning frantic. He dropped his daughter off at daycare in Portland, but daycare was closed. And we didn't think that he could leave his child there with a note on him, considering that she's three. And his daughter was more than willing to come down here, but I think he was reluctant to bring her down here today. He will be in later today, and you'll get to meet him later. Darian comes to us. He was with the Multnomah County DA's office, and prior to that, he worked with Story's law firm. And we also have in the audience Miranda Palmer. Miranda, if you could stand up and introduce yourself. She is from the University of Oregon Law School.
Hi, I'm Miranda Palmer. The tape is the official record, and to get on the official record, you have to be near a microphone,
okay.
Miranda.
Wow, I'm here for a moment. I'm Miranda Palmer. I'm a third-year law student at University of Oregon, and looking forward to working with the Judiciary Committee, both the representatives and the Senate. Thank you.
We also have in the audience, we're going to ask her to move up to the microphone too, is Kate Toswell, who's from Legislative Counsel's Office. This is her first session, and Kate can give you her background. She will be drafting primarily in the area of criminal law, and since we handle all criminal law, she'll be one of our primary drafters, she and Dave Hendricks.
Good morning. I'm Kate Toswell from Legislative Counsel. I'm a Deputy Legislative Counsel, and I am the drafter responsible for the areas of criminal law, corrections, the state police, and then also a few other areas such as polygraphs and investigators. And prior to coming to Legislative Council, I was in practice for 10 years, most recently in private practice in Portland, and before that practicing criminal law primarily in New York City. And I look forward to working with all of you. Thanks.
Kate, do you want to introduce the gentleman with you?
I'd also like to introduce Josh Nasby, who is working this session with Legislative Counsel. He's a staff attorney.
Thank you. Then we have over here on the keyboard is Patsy Wood, who is our office manager and has been for how many years, Patsy?
Eight.
Patsy runs the place, so don't. And would you like to introduce Jennifer and Sarah, too?
My staff this year, Sarah Campbell will be doing House Judiciary, and Jen Black is going to be handling the Senate Judiciary Committee, but you might see them back and forth, and so I wanted you to meet both.
Very good. And thank you, members and staff, for the work you're going to be doing here on the committee at this session. Our next item of business is to adopt rules for the committee, and you should have before you, members, a set of committee rules, about a page and a half of material here. These are a standard set of committee rules, so they're uniform for all the committees. There's nothing different about them for the Judiciary Committee. So at this point, the chair moves adoption of the committee rules you have before you for the House Committee for the 2007 session. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, then the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Yes.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Kong?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett?
Aye.
Chair McPherson?
Aye. Rules are adopted. We're now going to close the organizational meeting and open an informational meeting of the House Judiciary Committee, and we have some very special guests with us today to assist us in understanding what our role is in the legislative branch of government as it relates to the judicial branch of government, because we are all in this together trying to do better for the people of Oregon. We have an initial panel to present on statutory interpretation, the Honorable David Brewer, Chief Judge of the Oregon Court of Appeals, the Honorable Jack Landau, a judge on the Oregon Court of Appeals, and the Honorable Virginia Linder, Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court. Could you come forward now?
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Well, welcome, judges. We look forward to being educated.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. We're absolutely delighted to be here with you again today to discuss issues relating to statutory construction. My name is Dave Brewer. I'm the Chief Judge of the Oregon Court of Appeals and have been so since 2004. I understand this year you are on a pretty doggone tight schedule, and because of that, we have not done an orientation for the courts for you this year up front like we've done sometimes in past sessions. So today, what we'll be doing is presenting to this committee about an hour-long session with your indulgence on issues relating to statutory construction, which the three of us are going to be handling, and then to be followed by a panel consisting of Justice Reeves Kistler from the Oregon Supreme Court and Judge Dave Schumann of the Court of Appeals dealing with issues relating to constitutional law. And we hope that'll be of some use to you. We've had the privilege of working with many of the members of this committee in past sessions, including in inter-session activities and joint inter-branch work groups. And I personally have found that extremely rewarding. It's been part of what Chief Justice DeMunis and others among us in the courts consider a continuing conversation that's completely appropriate and positive between our among our branches of government, so that we'll have a better understanding of each other, of the roles we play, and we view this discussion today as an important part of that. We'd like this to be a conversation. Although we're going to be making some presentations here, we want you to feel free to interrupt us with any questions or comments you have at any time. Nothing like that ever offends us, and we want it to be useful to you, not just us sitting here as a bunch of talking heads. We do have a handout that I've asked Bill to pass around. I hope you have it. That handout consists of a list of selected statutes that you, the legislature, in past sessions have enacted that tell courts how to interpret the statutes that have been enacted. And to give you a little bit of background on that, the Oregon Court of Appeals, which is my court, Justice Linder, whom I'll introduce in a moment, on the Supreme Court, is the intermediate appellate court for the state of Oregon, as almost all of you know, and we handle about 3,500 to 4,000 appeals every year. We are a mandatory appeals court that takes every appeal as a matter of right from every trial court in the state of Oregon and all of the administrative agencies. We have 10 judges on the court when we're at full force. And that makes us, per case, per judge, just about the busiest appellate court in the United States, year in, year out. So we get an awful lot of volume coming through our court. And the reason we start off with this presentation is, I can tell you, I think my colleagues will agree, about 65 to 70% of the cases that actually get to the judge's attention involve matters of statutory construction. And by volume, and probably by level of overall social importance to the people of this state, that work is among, if not the most important work we do. So for us, understanding the rules that you've given us to interpret the statutes that you enact, and for you, we think, understanding how we view those rules and how we attempt to incorporate them into our work is absolutely critical for making sure that the system works properly in the way that it is supposed to work. So that's just a little bit of background about where we start from today. I want to introduce my colleagues at this time, but first I want to tell you a little bit about how we're going to divide this up. Judge Landau, who's seated to my right, is going to be making the primary presentation on the rules of statutory construction that the courts follow. Justice Linder, seated to my left, is going to talk a little bit about how some court-made gloss on those rules works and how we judges view our work. And we think that might give you a little bit of insight as you proceed with your work this session. But just by way of brief introduction, again, my background, I think you've shared yours, I think that's really helpful. I came from Lane County. I was an attorney in private practice in Eugene for 16 years. I mainly handled civil litigation, and in addition, I had a business practice. So I come from a business background. That's my background. After 16 years, I came to the Lane County Circuit Court. So I started out as a trial judge in Lane County for 6 years, and then I came to the Court of Appeals 8 years ago and became chief judge a little over 2 years ago. That's my background. Seated to my right is Judge Jack Landau. Judge Landau is a presiding judge of one of our three panels. We have three panels of three judges on our courts. He's a graduate of Franklin High School of Portland, Lewis and Clark College, Northwestern School of Law at Lewis and Clark, He has an advanced law degree from the University of Virginia. He served as a judge on the Court of Appeals since 1992. Before that, he had extensive experience in private practice and had the distinction of serving as Deputy Attorney General for Oregon. In my view, and I think in the view of everyone who knows him, Jack is one of the top scholars and teachers in Oregon on the subject of statutory construction. He teaches the class here at Willamette University School of Law. And as I said, he'll take the lead in our presentation today. Justice Linder of the Oregon Supreme Court is a graduate of Southern Oregon University and Willamette University College of Law. She served on the Court of Appeals from 1997 until December 31st this last year, when the people of the state of Oregon elected her as a justice to the Oregon Supreme Court to replace Wally Carson. Before coming to the appellate court, she also had an illustrious career in the Attorney General's office, capping that career as Oregon's top appellate lawyer, the Solicitor General. Judge Linder, like Judge Landau, as I'm sure you'll see, is a clear and careful thinker. She'll briefly describe, as I mentioned, the overall approach that appellate judges take in tackling statutory construction problems. And what we'd like to do, as we've done in past sessions, is today begin a dialogue with you that we think will be helpful in understanding how we follow your rules and to develop a relationship of communication and mutual respect as we continue through this session and just have it be the beginning of a conversation. So again, please interrupt us whenever you'd like. And Jack, please take it away.
Thank you, Chief, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. We really do welcome the opportunity to have this conversation with you about the work that we all do. A lot of scholars and teachers about the issue of statutory construction will often refer to that whole process as a conversation between the legislature and the courts. You speak through the statutes that you enact. We speak in terms of our written opinions interpreting those statutes. You may respond by further enactments. And that there's a certain level of conversation that gets referred to in those terms. What we're doing today, though, is really wonderful and unique. It's a real conversation. It's not one that happens through the printed words. This is a real opportunity for us to actually sit down and converse about the work that we do. I really welcome that opportunity. I think it would be hard to imagine a more important thing for us to talk about. As Chief Judge Brewer explained, we are the state's intermediate court of appeals. That means that we hear appeals from pretty much every corner of the state on every subject imaginable. In general, we review the decisions of trial courts and administrative agencies to determine whether those trial courts and administrative agencies applied the law correctly. We are what's commonly referred to as an error-correcting court. We're not primarily in the business of making law. That is, frankly, your job, mostly. Our job is to make sure that the trial courts and the administrative agencies follow that law. We decide whether the trial courts and administrative agencies committed reversible error by failing to follow that law, and then we explain the reasons for our decisions in written opinions. In determining whether the trial courts and administrative agencies have followed the law, we need to take a moment to make clear what we mean by the law. To begin with, we sometimes, though fortunately not often, have to apply federal law. The law can refer to the federal constitution and to federal statutes. Those are the supreme law of the land, and they control even if there is state law to the contrary. So, for example, last year, we had to determine whether certain Oregon administrative rules dealing with sentences that are imposed in criminal cases, known as Oregon Sentencing Guidelines, and you will no doubt hear a lot about those this session, are constitutional because they allow judges to depart from presumptively correct sentences by making certain findings And the U.S. Supreme Court said that a system very much like Oregon's in the state of Washington was unconstitutional because the judges are not authorized to make those findings. Those findings have to be made by juries. Now, it really doesn't matter whether we think that that is correct, because the United States Supreme Court has the last word about federal law, and federal law is the supreme law of the land. And so what we then have to do is apply that federal law to the Oregon cases, to the Oregon sentencing guidelines. And so not surprisingly, the Oregon Supreme Court decided in line with the United States Supreme Court that in certain respects the Oregon sentencing guidelines were unconstitutional, which necessitated some work from this committee and from the legislature in the last session. Fortunately, as I said, there are a few cases that actually involve federal law. Most of the cases that we see are governed by state law. When we say state law, it comes in basically four different kinds. And let me stop right now just to reemphasize something that the Chief Judge Brewer said. Please interrupt if you have any questions. As my colleagues will tell you, I can talk about this stuff all day. I really like my work. I really am proud of the work of the Court of Appeals, and I can pretty much go on as long as you let me. So for your sakes, you might want to just interrupt me if you have any kind of questions. The four types of law that we talk about are state constitutions, state statutes, state administrative agency regulations, and judge-made law, common law. Today what we'll do is we'll focus on two types of those state law, as they have most to do with the issues of statutory construction and the legislation that you enact, and so the relationship between the courts and the legislature. First, as I said, the state law can mean the state constitution. The state constitution, which includes everything that has been enacted by the people since 1857, when the original Constitution was adopted, and any amendments that were enacted or adopted since then by initiative, allocates power among the three branches of government and imposes limitations on the exercise of that power by each of those three branches. So, for example, although the legislature is given broad power to determine state policy, the Constitution says there are certain things that even the legislature can't do. To give you an example, the legislature cannot enact legislation that imposes one sentence in a criminal case for white people and another criminal sentence for black people, right? That's obvious. Article 1, Section 20 of the Oregon Constitution says you can't do that kind of thing. There are similar limitations on the courts. There are similar limitations on the executive branch. There are some things that each of us cannot do. Justice Kistler and Judge Schuman will talk more about that, and so we'll just kind of skip over to the second and most important for our purposes components of the state law, and that is the state statutes, the legislation that you enact, the 17 volumes of Oregon revised statutes that cover everything from abandoned property to zoning. Those statutes represent your collective wisdom about the various issues of concern that relate to the citizens of the state of Oregon. As long as your judgment doesn't violate a limitation in the Constitution, that's the law. And it's binding on us, and it's binding on everybody else that is subject to its terms. You should understand, and be real candid about that, we like that arrangement, all right? We did not become judges because we wanted to be policymakers. That's your job. Our job is to apply the law and make sure that the trial courts and administrative agencies follow it. What we need to talk about at this point is the business of applying the law. As Judge Brewer said, applying the law is basically what we do. In two-thirds to three-quarters of all the cases that we write opinions about, the principal issue has to do with interpreting legislative enactments. It's not the application of constitutional law, nor is it the development of common law principles. It's about statutes. Fortunately for us, in the vast majority of the cases, the legislation is pretty clear. As a student of this area of the law and somebody who's read a lot of statutes from around the country, I think the Oregon statutes rank among the best in the country in terms of the quality of the written product. If you have any doubts about that, just open at random any provision of the Internal Revenue Code. Open at random any provisions of, and I don't want to offend any particular states, but there are a number of states out there who would make you feel proud of the work that that this institution does and with the assistance of the very capable staff and the Legislative Council's office. In a number of cases, though, a couple of hundred a year, you have to remember we do get 3,000-4,000 cases, so it's not that many, but we do get a couple of hundred cases a year in which the answer is less certain. There is some ambiguity about what the statutes mean. Words sometimes just aren't quite as clear as we'd like to think. I know that's true when I write opinions, that they come back to haunt me. I thought they were very clear when I wrote them, and then I find out in subsequent cases that they weren't nearly as clear as I had thought. Sometimes it's a result of accidentally poor drafting. Sometimes it's just the nature of the ambiguity of words. What we have to do, though, is we have to decide what those mean. The courts don't have the prerogative of looking at an ambiguous statute and say, it beats the heck out of me. Let's send it back to the legislature. We can't do that. We have a case to decide in which the meaning of the statute is going to determine that somebody wins and somebody loses. So we have to make a decision regardless of how hard it is. So there are rules that we apply to determine what those statutes mean when it's not so obvious. Okay? Those rules come from two sources. The first source is you, and that's the collection of rules that Chief Judge Brewer handed out to you in ORS Chapter 174. The legislatures in states around the country do that, give guidelines for the courts that apply to all statutes. Sometimes it may be definitions that apply to all statutes of very common words like person or agency or individual, so forth. Sometimes they're general rules about statutes and the relationship with other statutes, like what is the effect of a repeal? What is the effect of a repeal of a repealing statute? What is the purpose of statutory construction? What are the limitations on the roles of the courts? There are also judge-made rules that have been developed literally over the centuries and that have addressed specific problems in construing many different types of documents, contracts, constitutions, statutes, regulations, and so forth. If you look at those statutes that we handed out to you from Chapter 174, you'll see that the object, the basic goal of statutory construction for the courts is to pursue the intention of the legislature if possible. That's a critical point for us to understand. Our job is to figure out what you mean when you enact the statutes. That is our overriding objective. How do we do that? We do that basically through a three-step process. We'll go through that step by step. The first step, and the most important step, is that we look at the words of the statute. In looking at the words of the statute, we are limited by what was actually written down on a piece of paper and voted by members of the committee, members of the full house, members of the committee in the other house, and members of the other full house, signed into law by the governor. That is an extremely important point. We are required to work with the language that you enact into law. If there's nothing else you remember from the remarks that we make today, it's this. We can implement your intentions only if you put those intentions into words that can reasonably be construed to do what you want. Okay? If the legislature, for example, accidentally leaves words out of a statute, we can't put those words back in. Okay? That isn't just a matter of caution or politeness on our part. That's because we don't have the authority to do that. If you look at those statutes that we handed out in Chapter 174, one of the things you'll see is that in the construction of a statute, the office of a judge is to simply ascertain what is and declare what is in terms or substance contained therein. And this is a part that you'll see
quoted time and again in our opinions.
And
not,
Jeff, this is the first statute, 174010.
010.
For those of you who are following.
See,
right?
Not inserting what's been omitted or omitting what's been inserted. If you put something in there, we can't ignore it. If you don't put something in there, we can't put it in for you. Okay? That's something that we take very seriously and that we deeply respect. Most of the time, the words are there. And the issue is what those words mean. In determining those words, we follow a couple of important rules. To begin with, the words mean whatever you want them to mean. Right? If you want, for example, to define the term motor vehicle to include motorized skateboards, all you have to do is say that. You can include in the definition section of the statute whatever you want those terms to mean, and if it's there in the definition section, that's the definition that we will apply in construing the statute. If you don't define them, then what we're going to do is we're going to assume that what you meant is that the words would be used in the ordinary way that words are used. Okay, we're just going to assume, because you didn't make a special definition, that they're just given their ordinary meaning, and that means that we're probably going to look at a dictionary. The courts particularly will tend to use Webster's Third New International Dictionary. We haven't ever really said, but my theory is that because Webster's, unlike some dictionaries, actually reports how words are used, it's not a kind of French academy that says this is what words have to mean. Webster's reports what people actually use words. And so, much to my chagrin, for example, if you check the addendum at the very beginning, it'll have a definition of the word like as a verb. And I'm like very upset about that. But it's in there. All right. So that's, I think, the reason why we use Webster's. That and the fact that it's got 450,000 words and it's probably the most comprehensive American dictionary in print. Of course, dictionaries will have lots of different definitions for each word. There are, for example, 200 different definitions of the word set. It's the longest, or the word with the most definitions. So the problem for the judges will be to figure out which of those definitions is the one that you most likely intended. And the way we do that is we look at the context and how the words are used in the sentences, how the words are used in other sections in the same bill, how the words are used in other statutes on the same subject. So, for example, we had an actual case in which the defendant was charged with the crime of manufacturing a controlled substance. It was marijuana. The guy had a marijuana grow operation in the basement of a lab that was owned by Pacific University. The problem was that the statute said that the penalty for growing this stuff is tougher if the manufacture occurs on public lands. Well, what does public lands mean? Well, it wasn't defined in the statute. In this case, the building was privately owned by the university, but it leased the land from the federal government. So was that on public land? And what we did, I mean, there are various definitions. Webster's defines it as just unreserved, unappropriated public domain lands open to entry, settlement, and appropriation. If that definition applied, the defendant probably would not be subject to the tougher sentence because the land was not unappropriated land open to entry and settlement. But what we noted in the opinion was that the legislature hadn't defined the term. We looked at some 200 other statutes in which the legislature had defined the term and employed it, and that it had a very broad meaning. It was basically land owned by the federal or state government without any restrictions. And we said, well, look, there's 200 other statutes in which the legislature has used in very similar ways the words public lands, and there doesn't seem to be any indication that the legislature intended there to be some more specific or different definition. And in the absence of any other indication of what you intended, we said it must mean that broader definition. And so this guy with his marijuana grow operation was subject to the stiffer sentence for growing the drugs on public lands.
Judge Landau, I have a question about that. You know, language is an organic thing. It changes over time. Do you look back at the a dictionary definition at the time, from the time the statute was enacted, as opposed to a more current dictionary, if there has been some significant passage of time?
Mr. Chair, that's a real good question, and the answer is because we want to know what the legislature that enacted the statute at that time intended, we're going to look at whatever evidence there is about the meaning of the term at that time. So, for example, if we have a statute that was enacted in the 1870s, what you will see is the court resorting to dictionaries that were in use at the time. Mm-hmm. If you have a statute that was enacted in the workers' compensation statute in 1917, for example, the Oregon Supreme Court resorted to a Webster's dictionary that was in effect at that time. In most of our experience, the words don't change that much, and it wouldn't seem to make a difference. But there are some very, very key cases in which the meaning of terms does change, and so depending on which dictionary you employ, it can make quite a difference.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Judge Lindau, in regard to the court being able to utilize a dictionary for definition, I know that juries are precluded from doing so. What is the distinction?
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, that's actually a real interesting issue. It's a little beyond what we do on the Court of Appeals, and I'll defer to the trial judge in our midst if I get this wrong. But what we try to do in trials is give the jury instructions that are a self-contained batch of instructions that we want the jury to follow, and we don't want them to follow anything else, to make sure that they are applying the law correctly when they go into the jury room and then apply that law to the facts of the particular case. Sometimes those instructions actually will include definitions, statutory definitions, dictionary definitions, if the lawyers and the trial court believe that that would assist the jury. But if they're not in the instructions, the court will generally instruct the jury, don't go doing your own research and trying to figure things out. Did I get that right, Chief?
Yes, Judge Lindau. If I may, Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, just to add a little bit to that, as a trial judge for many years, I was oftentimes made aware of the frustration that juries had because they felt they weren't getting enough information. Part of that relates to the fact we're dealing with an adversary system where the instructions that juries get are normally presented to the court by the litigants. When those are incomplete, the court has authority within the limits of the law to give additional instructions, but that doesn't happen in every case. What I experienced, though, sometimes, where if you had a particularly engaged jury, the jury would come back to the court and ask the court a written question, saying, we don't understand what's meant by a certain instruction. And in those situations, what I would do, and I think what most trial judges did, go back to the parties, say the juries are asking for further instructions. And my inclination either is or is not to give those instructions for a particular reason. And that sometimes could be because the jury might be trailing off into an issue that really wasn't in the case, and we couldn't allow that. But other times we did give additional instructions because that communication piece is important. What's most concerning, though, is where the jury doesn't come back and communicate with the court. And I occasionally had the feeling that didn't happen. But I always encouraged the jury, if they didn't understand the instructions, to ask written questions so that we could make sure that communication line was complete. But we limited the amount of additional digging the jury could do because the Constitution and the statutes of this state limit the jury's consideration to evidence in the record and the law as given to them by the court. And that prevents them from going out and doing their own self-examination or examination, which the parties might not even be aware of and therefore wouldn't have a chance to respond to. So it's kind of a fairness issue in that respect. I hope that answers your question.
Sometimes when we examine the text of a statute and we see how the words are used in context, we still don't know what the statute means. It could mean one thing, could mean another, reasonably capable of any number of different possibilities. What we do then is proceed to a second step in the analysis. We will look at the legislative history. Okay. Now, in talking about the legislative history, I want to offer an important caution. Legislative history isn't a substitute for good legislative drafting.
No matter how clear the legislative history is, if there aren't words in the statute to effectuate whatever intention that legislative history reveals, we can't do anything with it, right? So we're back to that message from the very beginnings. We have to have the words of the statute there to help us effectuate whatever you intended the statute to mean. What we use legislative history for is to help us pick from among the competing possibilities. It could mean A, it could mean B. Which one is the legislature most likely wanting us to pick? Well, we'll look at the legislative history to see if it's one or the other. Let me give you an example. We recently had a case, an interesting case, in which the issue was whether a defendant violated a statute that prohibits the alteration of a license plate, an automobile license plate. Specifically, what it said was an alteration is any frame, I'm quoting from the statute, or plate holder that obscures the numbers, the letters, or the registration stickers. Okay, that seems clear at first until you think about somebody with their little I'd rather be skiing license plate, and it obscures the word Oregon. Right? Now, did that violate the statute? It obscured a letter. But is that the letter that the legislature was really after? Was the legislature talking about, when it said obscuring or obliterating of numbers, letters, or registration stickers, was it that six-digit, the letters or digits registration number, or is it anything on the license plate? Well, you know, reasonably it could have meant one thing, reasonably it could have meant another. What we did is we consulted the legislative history. We found through colloquies before the Judiciary Committee in that particular case that what the legislature was really about was the registration numbers. The point of that statute was to make sure that when a police officer comes up behind, that police officer has the registration number so that it can identify the car and the car's owner. So we interpreted the statute accordingly. So we had an ambiguous statute, could mean one thing, could mean another. We go to the legislative history, and it becomes clear to us which one the legislature intended. Now, I've been asked by a number of occasions by friends of mine in the legislature how best to get the attention of the courts in developing legislative history. My first answer has always been, and by now you'll not be surprised, that the best tactic is not to rely on legislative history at all. The best tactic is to draft clear statute. But failing that, my advice is always that if you understand how the courts tend to use legislative history, you can develop strategies to get the message to the courts to get our attentions. First, understand that courts tend not to put a lot of weight into the remarks of lobbyists about what a statute means. I recall an incident in which a legislator interrupted a lobbyist in a committee hearing, and the lobbyist said, "Excuse me, but can you just hold off on your questions here? I'm trying to make a little legislative history." Right? Not surprisingly, the legislator was a little bit miffed, because frankly, the legislator had the better of the argument in saying, "I'm sorry, we make the legislative history, you don't." At the same time, the reality is that legislators, that committees have to rely on information that is provided to them by experts in a variety of fields. If you're confronted, if you're in energy and environment, for example, and you're dealing with complex engineering or chemistry issues on environmental statutes, frequently you'll hear from experts from the Department of Environmental Quality or what have you. In those cases, to the extent that those statements are helpful, what helps us is for you to say so. If you say somewhere in the work session or somewhere in the committee's deliberations that you thought something that somebody said was especially helpful to your understanding of the intended effect of the legislation, all you have to do is say that, and we get the message. Then we can do something with those statements of the lobbyists. Otherwise, we tend to look at that with a little bit of skepticism, because those are people, and there's no denigration of the lobbying profession. I used to lobby when I was in private practice. It's a useful part of the whole process. But frankly, they're paid to take a position, right? And so we have to look at their statements with a little bit of skepticism. What we need to know is if you're relying on those statements, though, then we know that that made a difference in terms of what your understanding of the intended effect is.
Once you get beyond that,
and you're dealing with statements that are made by legislators themselves. Is there any sort of order of preference or pecking order? Is there anything that gets our attention more than something else when it's a legislator's statement?
Yeah, there really is. Generally speaking, whoever is designated by the chair to carry the bill on the floor, for example, we tend to look at that person as a person of particular authority in the floor debates. If somebody drafted the bill, if there's a member of the committee that sponsored the bill, we will tend to look at that person's statements as carrying some extra weight. In addition, and frankly, if it's just especially clear, whether it's in the committee or on the floor, it helps. My favorite example is a statement in committee by then Representative Mannix in a workers' compensation bill, and he had sponsored, drafted a bill essentially to change the result or the interpretation of a statute that the Court of Appeals had given, and what he said on the record was, let's state for the record what it says here. First, this will do away with the current court interpretations of what is a new injury for responsibility purposes. Do you hear that, judges on the Court of Appeals? Members of the Workers' Compensation Board, when you read the transcript of this hearing, this does away with what you've been saying. Now, we didn't take offense to that. That was really helpful stuff. And in fact, it got cited, that very block, got cited by the Oregon Supreme Court in deciding what the statute in that case meant. If you say it clearly, it gets our attention, we're happy to oblige.
Jack, what about where it's said? Does it matter where the statement is made? What carries the most weight that way?
Well, that's a real interesting question. It depends on the legislature. In Congress, for example, the courts tend to look at things, the later in the process, the better it is. So floor statements sometimes may be given more weight than, say, committee hearings. In Oregon, it's almost the opposite, because Oregon's legislative process is very committee-centered. You know, there are no amendments on the floor. So much of the work is done in the committee, and frankly, there are a lot more opportunities for the legislators to explain, in particular, what they intend. And so we tend to look very carefully at the statements of the committee members. But frankly, because there's so little legislative history in Oregon, I mean, it consists of discs and tapes and minutes, we'll grab whatever we can. If it helps us understand what you intended a statute to mean, we'll use it. Finally, in rare cases, a couple of dozen, frankly, in the past decade, there are statutes that are kind of persistently ambiguous. We look at the text, look at the context, we look at definitions, we look at the legislative history, and we still can't really figure out what the legislature meant. As I said, we don't have the luxury of just kind of punting it back to you to say, what did you mean? We have to decide a case. So we've developed some rules that are kind of tiebreakers. They're presumptions. When all other things are equal, we assume, for lack of any other evidence, that this is what the legislature meant. So, for example, if we've got a statute that could mean one thing, it could mean another, but one of those things is arguably unconstitutional, we will always give the legislature the benefit of the doubt and say it's most likely the legislature didn't intend to enact something that's arguably unconstitutional. If the legislature enacted something that could mean one thing, maybe another, and one of them is arguably absurd as a policy matter, we will always give the legislature the benefit of the doubt and say, you know, they probably didn't intend the absurdity. Let me give you just a quick example before I close. A very, very interesting case. We confronted a case in which the criminal defendant was charged with the possession of a controlled substance. He'd been caught, or she'd been caught, with a plastic baggie of methamphetamine or a purse. The statute requires that to establish the crime, the state has to prove that the defendant knowingly possessed the substance. In this case, the defendant argued that although she knew the substance in the bag was illegal, she didn't know that it was meth. She thought it was cocaine. And the statute didn't say what it is precisely that you had to know. And if you look at just the words of the statute, arguably it could mean either one. You have to know it's illegal or you have to know the particular substance. The legislative history didn't give us any help on that, and so we looked to the absurd results, what we thought would be the absurd results canon, and said, wait a minute, you know, that we don't need to leave common sense at the door here. It just made more sense to us to say it's enough for her to, or for the state to show that she knew the substance was illegal, and it didn't matter that she may have been wrong about the fact that it was meth and not coke. That's one of those cases where it may be tough. We have to rely on those kind of canons of construction to resolve the ambiguity. Fortunately, those are rare. In a nutshell, then.
Excuse me, Judge Landau, yes. Representative Flores.
Yes. Yes.
Thank you, Judge. Before you conclude, I would like, in regard to your example relying on the presumption of the legislature, you said something to the effect that the legislature wouldn't pass something that's unconstitutional. Is the presumption then that everything that comes out of the legislature is constitutional, even though there might be questions?
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, that's a really good question, and in fact, sometimes you will see in the case law the courts using a phrase that we always presume that statutes are constitutional. In a sense, that's odd because presumptions generally apply to matters of evidence and matters of fact, and either a statute is constitutional or it's not, and that's a legal question. But I think in a more colloquial way, it does express what we do bring to the table when we look at these statutes. In the case of a statutory construction issue, when we don't know what the statute means, we will always give the legislature the benefit of the doubt and assume that what you intended was to enact something that's constitutional. Now, there are cases in which the legislature unambiguously intends to enact a statute that may push the envelope a little bit because they want a statute to be in the courts. They want there to be a constitutional test. Congress has done that on a number of occasions. And in those cases, the courts don't just say, well, you couldn't possibly have meant what you plainly said. Again, it's a question of legislative intent. And if it's clear, then we give that clearly expressed intent its effect.
Thank you.
So we regard the legislature as the principal policymaker. Our job is to give effect to those policies, but in giving effect to those policies, we're limited by a number of rules, the most important of which is that we have to work with whatever policies are expressed in the words of the statute. We don't have the authority to change those words, regardless of what we think the legislature may have intended. In interpreting those words, we give the words the meanings that the legislature chooses and the definitions that you enact. If you don't have definitions, then we will assume that you use language as all of us ordinarily use language. If the statute's ambiguous, we're going to consult the legislative history to figure out what you most likely intended the statutes to mean. If the legislative history isn't helpful, then we will rely on various rules that have been developed over history as substitutes for actual evidence of what you intended. I hope what I've done here is gives you a clear picture of the work of our court and our decisions concerning your handiwork, statutes and statutory construction. I hope if we can help you better understand the rules that govern our work in carrying out your intentions, we can make your jobs a little easier in developing legislation that clearly expresses those intentions. It's been a real privilege for me to talk with you. If you have any questions, be happy to answer them. Otherwise, I turn the...
Judge Landau, if I could just draw a takeaway message perhaps for the committee and maybe get your confirmation of this, that... For members who want to make sure that the intent that they hold about the words is the way that the statute will be applied, that a statement on the record here in this committee will be an effective way to do that.
But it's unnecessary if the language is sufficiently clear that really no one would imagine there would be any dispute on the matter. Is that a fair recap?
Mr. Chair, yes, that is. I mean, the first and foremost thing to think about is clearly expressing those intentions in the words of the statute itself, and secondarily, anything else you can do on the record to help us understand that what you intended is only going to help.
Mr. Chair, I wonder if I could real quickly say one thing, and then I think it's useful to have Judge Linder close for us, and that would be this. If you hear what Judge Landau is saying, is we're talking about a methodology, a process for interpreting statutes that lets us get to meaning as soon as we can using various stages. One of the things that sometimes happens, and this if we have a larger category of problem cases than any other, is where the legislature may not have thought of a particular application of a statute, but the words encompass it. And so a creative litigant will argue that a statute applies to a situation that you may not even have thought about at the time. And one of the things that we've always enjoyed sharing with you is the concern we have in cases like that, because the statute may clearly be applicable on its face, and we can't just ignore it. But we also may have a sneaking hunch from what you did say and from the legislative history that you may not have thought about this application. So one of the things that I think the three of us will strongly encourage you to do whenever you're looking at a statute and you're getting after a particular problem is think about the breadth of the words you're using and try to think about ways that it might apply that you hadn't thought of. I'll call that, the word's wrong, but gaming. In other words, gaming the problem. Thinking ahead so that you're not caught in a situation where you're looking back at some written opinion, some appellate court has written 3 years later saying, my God, did we intend to do that? And then it can create some problems with communication. So that would be my only addition. And then what we thought we'd do is the common sense of all of this is how do judges think about this? This methodology, Judge Linder's been at this for 27 years now, and I'd like her to just take a minute, talk about what the law was like before we had this methodology and what it's added to the process.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, let me say on my part as well, it is a real pleasure to be here and be part of this conversation between those of us in our branch of government working with the statutes that you enact and your part of the process and being able to have this dialogue about it. It really is very beneficial to us, and we hope it is to you. I have been, if I check my watch, I guess I've been on the Oregon Supreme Court about a week now. But as Chief Brewer's description lays out, I have been an appellate lawyer and in the appellate process throughout my career, which, as my gray hair reflects, is about 29 years worth at this point. When I started in the Department of Justice, I was still a law student, but I began by briefing cases in the Oregon Appellate Courts. That was about 1978. At that time, the legislature had been very busy through the 70s with some massive revisions of the criminal code, the criminal evidence provisions, the evidence provisions more generally, the juvenile code, the motor vehicle code, the Administrative Procedures Act. All of those things had some major comprehensive revisions during the 70s, and the legislative history was very fresh, and there were people throughout the Department of Justice that had a major piece of that as well. And from the beginning, the very first cases that I worked on, statutory interpretation was key to so many immediately. I have to say, I look back at those days and think about, I should actually pull out some of the briefs and read them, but I don't have to feel a little chagrined about how I approached it sometimes, and it was the way everybody approached it sometimes. It usually started with just looking at the statute, of course, and thinking about the words and what they meant, but I can remember distinctly times when I wrote into a brief that such and such a word ordinarily means such and such. Did I cite anything? No, I just thought it meant that.
And that's what lawyers did then. We just kind of talked about what we thought the words meant. All of the legislative history I remember distinctly from the criminal revision. There was an attorney in the DOJ at the time by the name of Don Paulette, who had been instrumental in the whole thing, and he was still working there. I'd go to Don Paulette, and I'd say, what does this statute mean? And he'd tell me, and he'd remember that it was in the legislative history, that there were things like that. And we had the binders. They were not too far from my office. I'd walk over. I'd pull them out. I'd throw that stuff into the brief. I'd throw a canon around, canon of construction, if that was helpful. And while I was doing that, the attorneys on the other side of the case were doing it as well. And the courts were doing it as well. There were all of the pieces that we've talked about often were in play. What wasn't there was any methodology to how we use them or in what order. As a result, it was kind of a cacophony of discussion between the attorneys and the court, in which everybody talked about what helped them, but nobody approached it in any particular way, and frequently arguments were sort of the classic ships passing in the night kind of phenomenon. That didn't trouble me because it was the only world I lived in. When the Oregon Supreme Court began announcing a more formalized methodology to statutory interpretation, it's PG 1993. It was actually doing the same thing in multiple contexts. It did the same thing and has been with contracts generally and special rules for insurance contracts and constitutional provisions. And I can say at first, I think, as a lawyer litigating, it felt constraining. It felt perhaps sometimes even a little artificial to have to go through steps in a particular order. And I think I and the attorneys I worked with in various cases would kind of chafe at the exercise a bit. Over time, though, as a lawyer first and now as a judge, I can say my perspective is it has fostered a much more coherent discussion in the process by the advocates who have to come before the court and talk about these things, by the court that needs to have that conversation with the advocates during an oral argument, and by a court that then has to write its decision. The benefit of it, I think it's like all tests. The PGE, the particular methodology template that we've adopted in Oregon, may not be perfect, but like so many things in the law and in tests, it at least has the virtues of having become familiar to people. And sometimes some tests persist because they do become familiar. They become familiar tools. They become predictable tools. And there's no consensus on a better test often. Even if one exists, you've got to get some consensus to adopt them. So my perspective as a lawyer is it became more satisfying eventually to be able to know exactly what it was that the court was going to expect you to discuss and in what way the court would expect you to discuss it. Your opponent would do the same. The court would approach it the same. And when the court writes its opinions, if it's being faithful to its own discipline, you will see the court, as you do in opinion after opinion, go through exactly that methodology. So I say all that to note that the rules that you provided in Chapter 174 were there when I was a young lawyer. What wasn't quite there was how to approach those rules and in what order. And that, I think, is what we've now been doing increasingly since 1993 in a way that we hope also provides some predictability, I think, to the legislature in terms of what you can expect from us. And disabuses increasingly the perception that can otherwise attach that this is kind of an ad hoc process by judges and that we're just injecting our own policy preferences into the statute. I think our goal is not only to be faithful to the intent of the legislature, but to communicate that faithfulness in our own opinions, and the methodology serves that. I'll just add one, I'll close by adding one aspect of the process of legislative interpretation through judicial decisions that I think also is a big piece of this. It comes at the other end, though. It comes at the point that the Oregon Court of Appeals, or particularly the Oregon Supreme Court, actually engages in the process and announces a decision about what a particular statute means. As I think most folks are familiar with the term, the Latin term stare decisis, we adhere to the system of precedent in our legal system, which is let the decision stand. And we are reluctant to very readily change precedent because we realize that once an announcement occurs on common law, statutory law, administrative law, constitutional law, any of those areas, there is virtue in predictability, there is virtue in even-handedness, there is virtue in sort of the public pronouncement from that. And so courts are very, very slow to revisit those things. Statutes are where that principle has its strongest hold, for the very reason that this body convenes every 2 years, and you are in a position, if you think that the appellate courts have gotten something wrong, you're in a position to change it. If you don't change, inaction is not, in anybody's book, I think, the best clue about what this body or anybody else intends. But if you don't change it in the face of a pronouncement from the courts about what it means, it suggests, at least inferentially, that perhaps you think that's right. And that virtue of predictability and even-handedness over time in the law takes hold. But that is one piece of it that I think is very important for this body to think about, is as those cases come down, it because of our choice to be particularly adherent to the precedents in statutory areas, it actually poses a new opportunity for the dialogue between the legislature and the courts, as we will take your inaction to be some clue that the courts have gotten it right. So that too becomes part of the ongoing conversation we have over time between your function and ours. So I'm going to turn it back to the chief. Thanks for having us here and the opportunity to talk to you. And I always enjoy going back through Judge Landau's presentation because it's always a renewal of our own understanding of the methodology and the various ways it plays out. Chief.
Thank you, Justice Linder. Mr. Chair, that concludes our presentation. I think we've been talking to you for about an hour. Justice Kistler and Judge Schumann are here waiting. We're here to answer any questions, but that concludes our presentation, and we'll be glad to step back if you need to take a break or if you're ready for our other panelists to come up. That's your choice.
Any further questions for this panel?
I have a question.
Representative
I was interested, Judge Linder, when you said that 174 was in effect when you were practicing, but the methodology was not, and then from your comments, the methodology seems to have been developed in the PGE case and after. Is there anything in the PGE case or in the case law afterward that would be helpful to have codified, whether it be in 174 or elsewhere, that would be helpful to the court?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, I'm not sure. I'm actually going to ask Judge Landau to comment too. I'm not sure that anything quickly comes to mind. To some extent, that's a policy choice on the legislature's part. I think the Supreme Court, in announcing the methodology in PGE, did so in a way that was very much designed to focus on the intent of the legislature that enacted the law, and the particular steps it goes through are various means to stay as close to that as possible, so that by the time you drop at the third level to canons of construction, at that point you're really the farthest away from an actual inquiry into intent. If for some reason, for example, among the raging debates, I think you'll hear more about this from Justice Kistler and Judge Schumann about interpretations, should you look into the subjective intent of the enacting body, or should you be looking at the objective meaning of words based on the understanding of the people who have to read them? You could, of course, if you want, flip the test around in that kind of a way. You could change the methodology, or you could approve of the methodology and perhaps lock it in. It may depend on the extent to which you want to give the court through a common law process some license to keep adjusting the test over time as necessity serves. So I don't have an immediate answer. I hadn't actually thought about ever codifying PGE 174. It'd be a very interesting discussion.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, that Chapter 174 is actually an interesting compilation of things, some of which date back to the DD Code of 1862. I mean, they've been around a long time, most of it, in fact. The stuff that's in 174.010 and 020 has actually been around a long, long time. What I think happened, as Justice Linder explained, is in 1993, the Supreme Court decided very self-consciously to make that statute the centerpiece of the statutory construction exercise, to take it seriously, not just to kind of leave it along the side. Over time, the legislature has, on occasion, added to that, and sometimes to codify doctrines that have been developed by the courts. For example, I'm not real good with numbers, but I think it's 174.060 it's 040 that talks about severability. That was actually enacted, if memory serves, in the 1950s to essentially codify a doctrine that the courts had developed about what to do when the courts declare some portion of a statute unconstitutional. What's the effect of that on the balance of the statute? Well, you sever it as long as there's a workable whole, and so on and so forth. There's a three-part test that the courts developed, and the legislature thought it useful to codify that so that everybody knew what the rules are. As Justice Linder said, that's a policy question for you folks, whether you think that's necessary.
I might add, Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, it's arguable, at least, that from time to time the legislature has tinkered a bit with the test. And an example of that, although it really hasn't been reviewed by the Supreme Court, is in one of the statutes that you have before you. It's in the middle of the first page. It's ORS 174.020 sub 3. And that statute says that a court may limit its consideration of legislative history to the information that the parties provide to the court. And so what the legislature has done there is told the court it doesn't have to go out on an expedition to look for things. So it's a refinement or a tweak, at least, of the test. Whether the legislature wants to comprehensively review the case and the Supreme Court's methodology, as Justice Linder says, is strictly a policy choice for the legislature, and we would value any conversation that you'd like to have about how it's working for you. So thank you very much.
Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair, earlier, I can't recall which one it was, had made a reference to enhanced sentencing, which was, I believe, Blakely, which we dealt with before, though we haven't talked about specifically about it. Are we done with that, or do you think we need to tweak it anymore?
Well, I'm not going to get into that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, it's my understanding that the so-called Blakely fix bill that the legislature enacted last time is now working its way through the trial courts. I don't believe that we've had any chance to construe any of those statutes in a meaningful way that would disclose that either you tried to do something that you may not have done with your words or some other problem with the bill. The awkwardness we have, frankly, of answering that question is the way these cases get to us, as you know, is through litigation that comes up on appeal. And all I can safely say to you is that I'm not aware of any particular interpretation problems, but those cases are still percolating, and I think it would probably be an excellent idea, if you're asking for our opinion on this, and I suspect you've already got this done, is at least to have a standby subcommittee that's looking at the issue of whether any problems appear to be surfacing, either for DAs or for defense lawyers in the trial courts. I think that's an excellent review process, but at least at this point, none of those problems have surfaced in our court. So, I've just been told to remind you of one other thing since you brought it up, and that is that the Blakely bill does sunset in 2008, and that is correct. So as a practical matter, you're probably going to need to take another look at it for that reason as well, but I know your counsel is on top of that. So thank you.
Any further questions? Then we thank you, judges, and Justice Linder, for your time and good education.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
And next, I'll call for our panel on constitutional law, consisting of the Honorable Reese Kistler, Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court, and the Honorable David Schumann, Judge of the Oregon Court of Appeals.
Well, thank you and good morning. It's always a pleasure and an honor to come here and be able to talk about what we do and learn about what you do and hope that it's helpful. The way Justice Kistler and I have divided up our time is that I'm going to make some remarks of a general nature about constitutions and what they are and what they mean in particular to those of you in the legislative branch. Justice Kistler will address some of the more specific topics in constitutional law that we understand may be of particular interest to this session of the legislature, and we will try and leave enough time for questions in case we have misgauged what you are interested in. I'm going to have to start with real basics. A constitution is called a constitution because it constitutes. When individuals who happen to be living in the same place at the same time decide that they want to constitute themselves as a people and turn themselves into a formal political community, they do that by virtue of a constitution in the American political system that turns out to be a written constitution, a charter. Constitution serves three purposes, basically. It sets up and structures and organizes a government, three branches in American politics, bicameralism in 49 out of 50 states, a unitary executive, a Supreme Court, and lower courts. It establishes the procedures that each part of government must use in order to make its work authoritative, sets up procedures. And that's interesting and important. If I go out in the street and announce that the speed limit on Court Street is 5 miles per hour, if any one of you goes out and says that, that's relatively meaningless. That's your opinion. That's my opinion. If this body, following the procedures set out in the Oregon Constitution, produces a law that announces that the speed limit on Court Street is 5 miles per hour, and then the governor signs it, that statement has become not anyone's opinion. It has become authoritative. And by that I mean that it's a statement that the government can legitimately enforce through, if necessary, the use of violence. The third function of constitutions is to limit government. When the people form a government, when they constitute themselves as a government, they generally agree to relinquish certain freedoms. For example, the freedom to drive 75 miles an hour down Court Street. But there are certain things that they don't relinquish. There remain some things that individuals can do that this government that they have constituted cannot do. Certain areas of individual autonomy into which government cannot intrude. We call those things rights, and they are spelled out in constitutions. So constitutions organize, they provide procedures, and they limit government. Let me begin to talk about a few of the procedural requirements that the Constitution imposes, such that if this body doesn't follow them, the product is not authoritative. There aren't many of them. They all stem from the Oregon Constitution and not the United States Constitution. The United States Constitution imposes no significant procedural limitations on what you can do. When I'm talking about the Constitution here, I'm talking about the Oregon Constitution. Obviously, bicameralism and presentment. The bill has to go through two houses, has to be signed by the governor. A quorum is required to do business. I'm not going to list all of them. Your council knows them. You know most of them. Floor sessions have to be open. Revenue bills have to originate in the House. They have to be passed by three-fifths in each chamber. Ones that might be of more interest to you are the so-called single subject rule. Every act, the Constitution provides that every act shall embrace but one subject and matters properly connected therewith, which subject shall be expressed in the title, the single subject rule relating clause. Now, as it turns out, those strictures in the Oregon Constitution don't turn out to have much bite. I think there has been one statute in the history of the Oregon legislature that did not pass the single subject rule. It was one of the so-called Christmas tree statutes that they, at the end of the session one year, that regulated everything from where cormorants could land to speed limits to everything else. But I'd let you know that it's there. What's probably of much more interest to you are the substantive limitations, not the limitations on how you can make laws, but the limitations on what laws you can make, because that's where the questions and issues are likely to arise. Let me begin with the limitations that are imposed, substantive limitations that are imposed by the United States Constitution. There are three sources of those limitations in the United States Constitution. The first is the Supremacy Clause, Article 6 of the Constitution, which says that federal law, the federal Constitution and the laws made pursuant thereto are the supreme law of the land. Some limitations derive from the Commerce Clause. We'll talk about those. Most of them derive from the Bill of Rights. Let me talk about preemption first, the Supremacy Clause. Article 6 says that United States law trumps state law. When they say United States law, they mean the Constitution, United States acts of Congress, and even federal regulations. A federal regulation trumps the Oregon Constitution. That's just the way it is. A conflict between state and federal law, which federal law is inevitably going to win under the Constitution, can be either direct. For example, the federal government can say that age discrimination is unlawful. Oregon could pass a statute saying that people over the age of 75 can't drive automobiles. That would be a direct conflict. Oregon's law would have to give way. Preemption or the exercise of supremacy by the federal government can also be implied. There are some fields of law that are so obviously federal that federal law is said to occupy the field, even if there isn't a specific statute that would preempt state law. For example, the regulation of airlines, foreign policy, that sort of thing. So those are limits that stem from the Supremacy Clause. There are limits that stem from the Commerce Clause of the Constitution, the clause of the Constitution that empowers the federal government to regulate commerce among the several states. This is a very tricky area of constitutional law, and I'm not going to spend much time on it. You won't have much chance to deal with this, but the reason it's tricky is because these are situations in which the states enact a statute and there's nothing out there in federal law other than the Commerce Clause of the Constitution, which tells Congress what it can do. In some situations, the Commerce Clause of the Constitution, just by being there, can exert an effect on state lawmakers, and that effect is state lawmakers are not allowed to make laws that have an undue burden on interstate commerce, even if Congress hasn't acted to exercise the commerce power. So, for example, if Oregon were to pass a statute saying every truck passing through the state of Oregon has to have curved mud flaps, you couldn't do that. Why? Because in fact that's a real case. The reason you couldn't do that is because it would burden interstate commerce if every truck coming south from Washington or north from California, where they didn't have such a law, had to stop at the border and change its mud flaps. Okay. Third, the federal government, the federal constitution, as everybody knows, has a Bill of Rights. Most of those rights apply to state government by virtue of the 14th Amendment. So, for example, this body, just like Congress, despite the fact that the First Amendment says Congress shall enact no law, that also applies to state legislatures. You couldn't pass a law limiting free speech, as Judge Landau pointed out, or a law imposing unreasonable searches and seizures, compelling self-incrimination, denying the equal protection of laws, unduly regulating firearms, etc., etc. Those are the substantive, those are in basic terms, the substantive restrictions that are imposed on state legislatures by the federal constitution. State legislatures are also limited by their own constitution. Oregon has a very robust constitution, and it imposes a number of limitations on this body over and above the limitations imposed by the federal constitution. Most of those are in the area of rights, although there are also some limitations stemming from, some substantive limitations stemming from the separation of powers provisions. Let me talk about the rights first very quickly. The rights guaranteed to Oregon citizens by the United States Constitution establish, as I said before, an area of personal autonomy into which state government cannot intrude or venture. The state is free to enlarge that area to create more individual rights or personal freedom than the minimum guaranteed by the federal constitution. The federal constitution establishes a floor but not a ceiling. So the state constitution can give the state's citizens an additional measure of the same rights that the federal government gives. For example, as Justice Kistler is going to talk about, the Oregon Free Speech Guarantee is written in terms that are much more generous about free speech, much more limiting about what government can do than the federal constitution. The same has been said of the Oregon's constitutional guarantee of equality. The Oregon guarantee of equality is somewhat stronger than the federal guarantee of equality. State constitutions can also confer on citizens of the state rights that aren't even mentioned in the federal constitution. Citizens of Oregon have a right to a remedy in due course of law to injury to person, property, or reputation. Article 1, Section 10 of the Oregon Constitution. There is no similar right in the federal constitution. Victims of crime in Oregon have certain rights that are part of the Constitution, part of what came into the Constitution as the Crime Victims Bill of Rights. Those rights are entirely absent from the federal Constitution. Separation of powers. Oregon has a very explicit separation of powers clause. There's no clause in the federal government in the federal constitution requiring separation of powers. It's been sort of created by courts. Article 3 of the Oregon Constitution is very explicit and has been construed to pack a lot of punch. The separation of powers limits the legislature in two basic ways. First of all, the legislature can't pass laws that assign the functions of one branch to the members of another branch. So, for example, you couldn't empower your members to hold trials or give them the authority to arrest lawbreakers. Courts, by the same token, can't raise funds or arrest lawbreakers. Now, there's an important wrinkle to this, as you know. The legislature is allowed in modern times to create administrative agencies. Administrative agencies are technically within the executive branch. Executive branch agencies can engage in rulemaking, and they can hold hearings that are quasi-adjudicative. So there's kind of a modern overlay to that part of the separation of powers that has to do with administrative agencies. To the extent that administrative agencies can make laws, even though they're in the executive branch, those laws have to be made under delegative authority from the legislative branch. To the extent that they can hold things that look a lot like trials, administrative hearings, there has to be judicial review of the outcome of those things. So that's how this sort of unnamed fourth branch of government exists. The other thing that the legislature can't do by virtue of the separation of powers provision of the Oregon Constitution is pass laws that unduly interfere with another branch's ability to perform its core function. So, for example, and this is a very unexplored area of constitutional law, the branches don't try and do this very much. But if, for example, the legislature tried to pass a statute limiting the Supreme Court to one session per year to meet in an undisclosed spot or something like that, it couldn't happen. If this branch wanted to limit the jurisdiction of the Oregon Supreme Court only to criminal cases, it couldn't do that. That's an interference with the core function of the judicial branch. Same thing would happen under an attempt to interfere with the core function of the executive branch. Quickly, in summary, a constitution constitutes, it organizes and limits government. Limitations are either procedural, that is, they have to do with how you make laws, or they are substantive, having to do with what kinds of laws you can make. They stem from both the state and the federal constitution. Under the federal constitution, you can't enact laws that conflict with federal law. You can't enact laws that interfere with interstate commerce, and you can't enact laws that violate the Bill of Rights. Under the Oregon Constitution, you have the same Bill of Rights and separation of powers limitations. There is constitutional law in 20 minutes. Usually it's a two-semester course in law school. That's all you need to know to pass the bar.
You have a question?
No.
Mr.
I'd like to have the credential that goes with that.
All right. Well, there, for those of us who are members of the bar, we actually are qualifying for CLE credit by our attendance. Judge, I thank you for that summary. Something that may be a useful item to explore here right now, if it isn't already going to be part of the program that Justice Kistler is going to describe, would be the process of amending the Constitution and how the role of the legislature in doing that, and particularly that distinction between amendments and revisions to the Constitution.
Do you want to take it? I'll start. In any event, to amend the Oregon Constitution, that can happen in two ways. It requires a vote of the people. It can either be done by initiative, where the people originate the idea, or this body can refer constitutional amendments to the people, and then the people can vote on them in a plebiscite. The revision of the Constitution is a much more laborious process. It involves, I believe, two-thirds vote in each chamber calling for a constitutional convention.
I think those are all. It doesn't require a constitutional convention. Okay. I think it requires a certain higher percentage of vote to refer to the people.
In any event, that's never happened. Oregon has the oldest existing state constitution in the country. It almost happened. It failed by a revision of the Constitution failed by one vote in 19, I think it was 60 or 62. No. But it hasn't been revised. Now, the way that comes before our courts is if there's a constitutional amendment that is so pervasive that someone says, wait a minute, that's not an amendment, that's a revision. It usually hasn't gotten two-thirds vote, and so it's challenged on the grounds that it should have.
And Mr. Chair, if I could add to that, my understanding is part of what may be going on in your question is when do you have an amendment and when have you gone too far to have a single amendment? And that plays in a little bit to something that Judge Schuman referred to earlier. It's similar but different. When you put a bill together, it only has to be a single subject. And a single subject, as he mentioned, can be very, very broad. It can encompass a number of different things that are all related to each other, but sometimes fairly loosely. Over the course of the last 5-10 years, the Supreme Court, beginning with Armada, has said that when you have an amendment, you have to send a single amendment one at a time, or you have to do it by way of revision, which requires a more difficult procedure. And the question has been, when have you got a single amendment? And if you have something that's easy, it changes the free speech provision, and it also amends the debt limits. You're having two separate pieces of the Constitution that probably don't have much relationship to each other. Where it gets more difficult is where you have two things that are kind of in the same ballpark, and you have to ask, are they closely enough related to be considered a separate amendment or not? It is a difficult subject to define, I think partly because you don't really know what it looks like till you start talking about specific amendments, and then you have to make judgments based on the relationship between those two sets of amendments and or two changes to the Constitution, and that has proved, I think, it has raised issues when you have initiated amendments coming up and the courts, after the initiated amendment has passed by majority of the vote, to ask whether this has more than one amendment and therefore can't go to the people as one as a single vote, because the idea is if it has separate policy choices, you want the people to be able to vote on the separate policy choices one at a time without lumping them together. But because you can put some of them together, then the question is, are those close enough? And if you look at what happened in Armada, where there were changes to the various pieces of the Constitution, the court said that wasn't good enough. The legislature referred it back to the people as separate matters to vote on. And when the people voted on them separately, they said yes is to some and no is to others. And so apparently when they had the opportunity in the various pieces of that what had been Measure 40 that went to people all together as one large measure to change the Constitution, they said yes to it, but when they were able to vote on it separately, came back and said, well, no, some of those we really don't want, and some of them we do want. And at least in some senses, in that instance, you can say that perhaps that's proof that there were things that were lumped together that had the people given the opportunity to vote on may not have approved altogether. But again, it's always a difficult process, and the court recently fractured 313 over whether a particular change to limitations on forfeitures was more than one amendment or a single amendment.
So a provision that such as the one that was declared unconstitutional in Armada was not declared unconstitutional because it was a revision of the Constitution, but rather because it made two or more changes to the Constitution that weren't closely related. That violates a different provision of the Constitution. Something will be considered a revision and fail for that ground only if there's two ways that can happen. One is if it's called the quantitative. If you just sort of take a little red pencil and underline all the parts of the existing Constitution that it changes, and there's a whole lot of them, that's probably a revision. The other is if it works such a fundamental change on government, even if it only makes one small change. For example, it decides that there will be a king instead of everything else. That's a revision.
And I think it's bad to get two people, one a former law professor, another an advocate, because we want to keep adding. But I think as a practical matter, if you have something that doesn't qualify as a single amendment, but you want to put it together as a package to send to the people, the way to do it is by way of revision. There is no, it may not constitute a revision, but it can only be passed as a revision if you want to put it together and say, please vote on this as a package. So the possibility of sending things together as a package is out there. It simply requires a greater number of votes on the legislature to get it to the people.
Representative Krieger, or Flores, I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah.
Just close, yeah.
Thank you, Judge and Justice. In regard to your reference to the Armada decision, and that can be the pivot point where the single subject rules can became famous, could you give us, just for reference, the elements that were determined to be more than violate that single subject rule?
Mr. Speaker and Representative Flores, my memory of Armada is there were multiple changes to the Constitution. The court focused on two sets, and I'm not probably going to get them right, but one was the number of jurors needed to have a murder conviction. It went from, I think, 12 to 10 or 11. So they said you don't need a unanimous jury verdict for a murder. So that was one change they made to the Constitution. And the other was how you set bail. And so the court said, and sometimes it's kind of, and I don't mean to demean the court's analysis, but sometimes when you look at it, you sort of see it, and you look at it and you say, gosh, those don't look very similar. And the court said something like, well, the number of jurors you need to have a murder conviction is wholly unrelated to the procedures for setting bail. Yes, they're all part of a single subject, which the legislature could have passed as a law, presuming that it didn't violate the Constitution. But when you come to constitutional amendments, we want to make sure that before you put a number of different things together in a single package, that they have a closer relationship than just having this sort of connection that they relate to criminal procedure. And there was another set of examples that the court used in saying that also was a significant change. I think one was a change to suppression motions, and I can't remember the other piece they put that was parallel to it. There were also certain victims' rights pieces in Armada. And so the court said, when you look at those, you know, you're changing existing constitutional provisions that at least have always been regarded as embodying separate policy choices. And so when you kind of put it up as a package, we worry that these aren't closely related enough to let the people express their will individually as to each policy choice. To go back to the original program, I wanted to start off by saying that first, as Mr. Chair, that we are very happy to be here. I'm very happy, as with the other members, to be here, to be with the committee. I think what we see our presentation
and
is doing.
If I could just break in just to identify, we've now shifted from Judge Schumann to Justice Kistler, so for purposes of the record.
And I think it's to share with you what we understand about constitutional law so that as you go through the process of enacting bills, to the extent we can shed any light on how the Constitution works, it helps you to enact bills that comply with the Constitution, as we understand it. I wanted to talk, because we were doing somewhat of sort of process and specific provisions, we had split it up. I was going to talk slightly about judicial review, shortly about Article 1, Section 8, and then Blakely, although I think Blakely may well have been covered in response to Representative Krieger's question earlier. And judicial review, I think, is really a fairly easy concept. The idea starts with the idea that courts have to decide cases. And if you have one litigant who comes in and says, I have a statute that gives me this right, and the other litigant comes in and says, no, but I've got a constitutional provision, and that statute isn't constitutional. In order to decide the case that those two litigants are asking the court to decide, the court has to come to a judgment about, does the statute comply with the Constitution? It's almost forced on the courts as a matter of necessity in order to do our function to have to make that judgment. And I think there are three pieces I just want to mention briefly about judicial review. First, it's one that we don't do, try not to do unnecessarily, only when we're required to. Only when the case makes us get to that constitutional issue then at that point, if that's what the case turns on, we have to answer that question, does the statute violate the Constitution? Second point is related, and it is that essentially, you know, we will try as hard as we can to avoid a constitutional question, because once we have to say what the Constitution means, then that limits the legislature, and we try not to do that. The third piece, and it's not something that I think this body would misunderstand, but every now and then you see stuff in the paper that you think people really don't understand what we're doing or don't appreciate what we're trying to do when we have asked whether the statute is constitutional, and one of the things that comes to mind is Measure 37. And I remember there were articles in the paper before Measure 37 got to my court saying, well, do we think the Supreme Court likes this or doesn't like this? There was a case that dealt with the takings clause, and there was an article saying, well, maybe this foreshadows how they're going to feel about Measure 37. And at least from my perspective, and I believe the perspective of the other judges on the courts, it isn't how we feel about Measure 37 or any particular law. We may think it's great policy. We may think it's very bad policy. But that's not, when we ask whether it's constitutional, that's not what we're asking. We're asking whether is there some specific provision in the Constitution that this violates, so that even if someone doesn't feel the law is a wise choice, again, it's not what we're there to decide. We're there, does it violate equal protection? Does it violate some other provision in the Constitution? We're not passing on the wisdom of the law. And there may be laws that we feel, gosh, if I were in the legislature, I wouldn't have voted for this. But, of course, it's constitutional, and we uphold it. Because that, I think, is our job in judicial review. Now, for the piece that's a little bit more complex, and I want to try to make it, I understand it simply, is Article 1, Section 8, because Bill Taylor suggested that was one of the issues that might come up in front of the committee or the committee might be dealing with. And I want to go back something briefly to what Judge Schumann said, and since he is also a professor and a scholar on these things, I hope he will correct me. But you start off with the idea that the federal Constitution sets the floor. The First Amendment says, okay, these are the minimum protections that are available to people in terms of speech. Article 1, Section 8, which is our Oregon free speech provision, goes beyond that. And the primary difference, and I'm going to suggest, is in this, and it starts out with a case called Robertson. And I'm also going to, before I say it, I want to just give you a little bit of a disclaimer. My assumption is that the analysis has progressed since Robertson, but I want to start with what I think was really going on in Robertson and then talk a little bit about two changes since then in Stoneman and in Ciccinelli. And I think the idea, well, an idea behind Article 1, Section 8 in Robertson is relatively straightforward. And it's, how do you write the law? Say you're concerned that somebody in Portland is having these political parades, and the political parades are tying up traffic. One way to write the law would be, say, no political parades. The other way to be would be to say no gathering that results in traffic congestion. Okay. What Robertson said is if you're concerned about something that's associated with speech, what you need to do is to name in the law the harm you really want to prohibit. That is, if you believe it's traffic congestion, prohibit things that create traffic congestion, not political parades, because not all political parades may cause traffic congestion. And if you say that, you've gotten a law that's too broad and reaches things that didn't really get to the harm you wanted to get. At least when I was a lawyer in the Department of Justice, the way I understood Robertson when it first came out was essentially twofold. One is, don't use speech as a proxy for the harm you're trying to prohibit. And the second fold thing was Robertson said, but there's an exception. And the exception is if it's so well understood at the time that we adopted the Oregon Constitution that this was a permissible restriction on speech, a law written against speech and saying this law is written in terms directed at speech. But if that was so well established, like a law prohibiting blackmail, obviously a crime that involves speaking, we're going to assume that the framers didn't intend to get that. In other words, they didn't intend to do away with the crimes prohibiting blackmail, solicitation, other kinds of well understood things, because even though they used the phrase no law, they obviously didn't mean no law, they meant to create this kind of exception. Now, I have to confess, when I was advising my client, I would always sometimes wonder if I can state the example about parades fairly easily. There are other instances in which speech is involved where it is harder to be able to name the harm you're trying to get without naming speech. In other words, you're trying to prohibit a particular kind of speech. Well, the one that always that I used to litigate when I was a lawyer was you're trying to regulate signs. In other words, you want to permit some signs but not permit others. If you say, and one of the difficulties is, can you say no signs except signs that regulate the speed limit? Well, signs that regulate the speed limit may in fact be a subject of speech. It may be something else. But have you then somehow written your law in terms that are directed at speech rather than simply the effect you want to prohibit? If you say, you know, no signs whatever, you're in trouble because there are obviously some signs you want. And the question that sometimes is very difficult, and I don't mean to suggest it isn't, for the legislatures, there are areas of the law where writing it in terms that are aimed at the effect and not speech are very difficult to achieve, sometimes difficult. Now, I want to drop down. There are two cases that then sort of, I think, make changes on what I had at least understood Robertson said. One is called Stoneman. Stoneman was a case involving the commercial distribution of materials involving children, for not children, pornographic acts. And at least one of the things that Stoneman said that perhaps people hadn't understood until Stoneman announced it was that it would be okay if you wrote a law in terms of speech as long as the, quote, actual focus of the law was the harm and not the speech. In other words, and there's a sort of a second qualification in Stoneman which suggested that one condition would be that this speech would always involve the harm. In other words, and it made sense in the context of child pornography involving children because Stoneman's point was that having a child be involved in the production of a pornographic picture or tape or whatever was always going to be harmful to the child. And it went through a process whereby it determined, whereby the court determined, that essentially the legislature's true focus, even though they talked about pornography involving children, which was described in terms of the speech, was actually aimed at what the legislature had understood to be a harmful effect.
And the harmful effect, the key to that was that the harmful effect occurred every time there was a photographic representation of children engaging in a sexual act.
Yeah.
A crime had been committed, harm had been inflicted. There was not, unlike a situation where there would be political parades in which traffic wasn't blocked.
Yeah.
So that the harm and the expression, as it were 100% identical.
Yeah. And that was, and I think there are two things that are difficult in Stoneman. One is the 100% rule, to the extent it's there. And the other is trying to figure out what the legislature's actual focus was as opposed to something else. It's a little bit of a guessing game. But that at least is one sort of landmark along the road in Article 1, Section 8. The other one is Ciccinelli. And I had understood when I was, again, a lawyer, that the historical exception meant if it was really well established at the time they adopted the Constitution, if the legislature then enacted a law directed speech that was within that exception, it was probably okay. When I was on the Court of Appeals, we voted to uphold the law prohibiting sexual acts in live shows. Because we thought it came within that exception. The majority of the court thought it did. The Supreme Court has said no. In Ciccinelli, the historical exception's not quite that broad. And it went back to Roberts and said it has to be both something that is well-established and that the framers didn't demonstrably intend to overturn. And it asked, well, how do you tell whether they demonstrably intended to overturn this sort of well-established exception? And the court said it turns on whether the law that falls within the historical exception is one that was really kind of aimed at harms to other people, as opposed to discomfort with the kind of speech. And as it looked at the kind of examples like blackmail, coercion, fraud, all of which were speech-related crimes, it said those harmed people in ways. Fraud deceives you. You lose money as a result of the fraud. Blackmail coerces you to give up something you didn't have to give up. So as it read the historical exception, it has to be well-established and a kind of thing that carries with it some form of harm. Now, you can debate the nature of the harm in certain instances, but the court perceived that the law at issue in Ciccinelli didn't go so much to a harm as it went to a discomfort with a kind of, or dislike of a particular kind of speech, pornographic expression, or sexual expression. And therefore, those are, as I understand them, the guidelines generally. There's kind of, I used to think when I was a lawyer that if you got past the first level and you wrote the statute the right way, you ought to be home free. But the court kind of pulled the rug out from under my feet, starting with Roberts, and said, well, there's still a second ground. Even if you've got a law that's directed, and I would be remiss if I didn't mention it, even if you have a law that's directed in effect and not at speech, written in terms directed in effect and not at speech, but speech is an element of the law, it still has to pass an overbreadth test. An overbreadth is a kind of thing where it's a federal test, essentially, and the federal test is if the law sweeps both protected and unprotected expression within its reach, and it gets too much protected expression, and too much is not too big an amount. But if there's an insignificant amount, it's probably not overbroad. If it's got a little bit too much protected expression to it, then that will be problematic, and the law will be unconstitutional also, probably under the First Amendment as well as Article 1, Section 8. But that piece of analysis is also part of Article 1, Section 8. Typically, however, if you truly can write a law solely in terms of effect without naming the speech, you're probably not going to have a problem with overbreath, bottom line.
I think really the take-home message would be this, and this is much more elemental and simplistic than what Justice Kessler was saying.
I thought it was pretty elemental.
If the law outlaws a harm, even if it's a harm that can be produced by speech, but it only outlaws it when the harm occurs, 99% of the time, you're fine. Yeah. If the law specifies there are certain things that you cannot say or do expressively, like dancing, but if the law actually says you can't say this, regardless of whether harm actually occurs or not, 99 times out of 100, that's unconstitutional.
So if you had a law that said you can't deface government buildings, and someone comes along in the government building, writes political expression, you know, I like Governor Kulongoski, I don't like Governor Kulongoski, the fact they were expressing themselves politically while defacing the building probably wouldn't save them. It would be a prohibition against defacing the building, and the law would be indifferent to how you defaced it, whether it was non-expressive at all or whether it said something, whether it had a message. The other point I just wanted to touch on briefly was one that Representative Krieger mentioned, which is Blakely. And you all probably know that. It's essentially a federal constitutional requirement that if you increase the punishment beyond what the jury found in its verdict, in other words, so like if there's a statute that says for assault you get 10 years, but if you have assault with a gun you get 15 years, that additional 5-year increment for assaulting with a gun has to be found by a jury and has to be found beyond reasonable doubt. And that changed a lot of sentencing schemes and criminal law schemes, both for the federal government and for the states. And my answer to you, Representative Krieger, Mr. Chairman, Representative Krieger, would be very similar to the one that Chief Judge Brewer gave. So far, we have not seen, at least we, and we are a step behind the Court of Appeals in getting cases, we have not seen people coming to us with problems with the bill, the Blakely fix that the legislature enacted last session. So to the extent that we haven't seen problems, the message I draw from that is that there's been no urgent problem that has come up to us that we've seen. And in talking with district attorneys sort of off the record, I've understood from them that things seem to be working, that people seem to be able to resolve it. Now, I don't know whether there are issues out there that people have problems with and we may see, but for the moment, everything, it seems to be a relatively good answer. Now, there's still some questions that are running through the appellate courts. There's some in front of us now, like whether Blakely applies to consecutive sentencing rather or concurrence. In other words, because there's a presumption in or the argument is, the way the Oregon statutes work right now, if you're convicted of multiple offenses, so you're convicted of 2 or 3 counts of robbery or burglary or whatever in the same time, the judge typically will have an option. He can either take the sentences for each offense and run them concurrently, that is, they all run simultaneously, so you got 5 years on each one. If you run them concurrently, you're out in 5 years. He can either run them consecutively and stack them, so it would be 15 years. The way the Oregon statutes work right now, they say we presume they will run concurrently unless the judge finds certain facts which would authorize him or her to run them consecutively. The argument that's currently in front of the courts is, given that presumption, do the facts that the judge has to find in order to run the sentences consecutively constitute facts that are going to be subject to Blakely and have to be submitted to the jury and found beyond a reasonable doubt? Or is this such a separate concern from the concern that drove the court in Blakely that the judge can continue to make those findings without sending them to the jury, without finding them beyond a reasonable doubt? The Court of Appeals has answered it, I believe, and said they aren't subject to Blakely. Well, I think it was divided court in bank.
Yes.
And we have that issue in front of us. And it was actually in front of the U.S. Supreme Court in a case that they ultimately didn't reach it in this term.
I think my answer to you, Mr. Chair and Representative Krieger, is that we're still seeing a lot of Blakely issues. What did the Supreme Court really mean by this, that, and the other thing? Does it apply here? Does it apply there? But I haven't seen anything that would call, so far, that would call into question the so-called Blakely fix from the last session.
Yeah.
That hasn't been a problem, and I think we would have seen it by now.
Yeah.
But I can't, you never know.
And we don't have anything else in our presentation that we had planned. We are happy to answer questions, and any way that we can help the committee would be delighted to.
Let me find out if there are any questions. Seeing none, then, Judge Schumann, Justice Kistler, we really appreciate the education you provided us today. It was great.
Well, thank you very much for having us.
Committee, that concludes the business for the day. I'll just wind up with a reminder that we do have the prison tour scheduled for tomorrow, and that is set to begin at 8 a.m. rather than the later deferred start to 8:30 that we'll be following for a while. Your staff members are welcome to join the tour as well, but they do need pre-arrangement. Members do not, but there needs to be a pre-arrangement with the Judiciary Committee staff office if you're going to send a staff member, so there can be an advanced security arrangement made. And that office, for those of you who are new, is down this corridor and just across the hallway. You'll find that Patsy Wood and her staff will be very helpful to you in various things related to the committee's work. Thank you very much. That concludes our meeting.